do today is at least give a hint of some of the ideas involving the proof of the theorems I stated last time. But I will recall for the benefit at least of one person who was not here yesterday what the statements were. Sorry? Very important person. Okay, so the first part concerned the Dirichlet-Riemann map and electrical impedance tomography. And I'm going to discuss the three-dimensional case first, or higher. And so we have the conductivity equation of divergence type, where this is an anisotropic conductivity on a domain. And then, so let me just actually go, well, this was starting on a domain in Euclidean space. So gamma is the anisotropic conductivity, depends on direction. It's a symmetric and positive definite matrix. U represents the voltage, and I'm going to assign a voltage potential F on the boundary. And you measure the voltage to current map, or the Dirichlet-Riemann map, which is given as the conormal derivative, in fact, with respect to the associated metric at the boundary, where mu will be the unit inner normal to the boundary. I'm just used to do it the other way, as I said yesterday. Okay. And so the inverse problem is whether we can recover gamma, the conductivity, by making this boundary measurements. The Dirichlet-Riemann map. Okay, that's the inverse problem. So this is called the voltage to current map because F is the voltage potential and lambda gamma of F is induced flux at the boundary. And so the answer is no. And then I will immediately relate it to geometric problems. So if you take a Riemannian metric, it's a positive definite symmetric metric as before. You can also define the Dirichlet-Riemann map for harmonic functions. This is the Laplace-Beltrami operator on the domain. And then you can define the Dirichlet-Riemann map, so U at the boundary is F, to be the conormal derivative. So this is very similar to what we had yesterday with a minus sign. I should have said minus because it's a unit in the normal. I'm never good at signs at the boundary. Okay. And one can easily see that the pullback by a change of variables, so you take a change of variables, a diffeomorphism that leaves the boundary fixed. Then we have the measurements are preserved under this condition. The pullback is just the differential, the composition of the differential, composite G. The other way around for the pullback was this side. So the question is whether this is the only obstruction. So this is a big open problem. And actually the problem should be set up because of this connection between the conductivity and Riemannian metric. In fact, the Riemannian metric is simply the determinant of the conductivity to the power 1 or n minus 2 times the inverse times the conductivity. So that's why this connection is only valid in dimension 3 or higher. One should do it on manifolds, because you're looking at the isometry class of the manifold. Can you recover the manifold and the metric? So in other words, you want to recover this, so it makes sense on the manifold. And so the question is, you are given the Dirichlet-Neumann map and given the boundary, can we recover the manifold and the metric? That's the geometric problem. And in dimension 3 or higher, this very little is known about this problem, and I want to explain why by doing what we know. This is only known for real analytic manifolds. There are slightly less assumptions that you need, but let me just wait. But in fact, even in this case, you can recover not only the metric, but the topology of the manifolds. You have holes or handles. Okay, so what's the difficulty? The difficulty comes from the way we have been attacking this problem that really started with Calderón as Adrian pointed out in his lecture. I wasn't here, but I'm sure he did. By using complex exponential solutions or complex geometrical optic solutions, the way I call it, and this has worked very well for isotropic conductivities or metrics, but we don't know the analog of that except in the two-dimensional case for very special reasons in dimension 3 or larger. So this is unknown for isotropic conductivities or metrics. But unknown for anisotropic, for the general case. So let me go back to the isotropic case. So in the isotropic case, I'm going to go back to the actual conductivity equation because it's easier. So isotropic case, for the conductivity, and we're in Euclidean space now. And sigma is just a scalar function instead of a tensor, and it's positive. So this is the conductivity equation. The Dirichlet-Neumann map in this case, if u at the boundary is f, is simply sigma times the normal derivative with a minus sign because of my convention at the boundary. And so it simplifies quite a bit. And it's known, so the theorem, and this is an old result of Sylvester and myself. You know, the notion of all, unfortunately, this is as Adrian was telling me, you know, these young people are talking about old result in the 90s. So it makes you feel old, you know. This is in the late 80s. So is a unique result, and this, there are many more results, but I'm just going to talk about this one, implies sigma 1 is equal to sigma 2. And this is true for, say, for C2 conductivity. There have been some improvements on that, but. So let me tell you quickly, I know this is supposed to be an introductory talk, and I see some young people here. What is, I know some other people here are experts and know about all about this. How does the proof go? Because there is a point in trying to find another proof, because this proof breaks down considerably for the anisotropic case. Okay, so what one does is reduce to the Schrödinger equation. Question? And this is already a bad idea, but we don't know how to do it otherwise. So, as I said, my point is really to point out what are the problems in extending this result in to more general situations. So you consider the change of variables, dependent variables, W square root of sigma times U, and W solves now the conductivity equation, the Schrödinger equation, sorry, with a potential given by Laplace and a square root of sigma over a square root of sigma. So from an equation that was had that this is the coefficients is in the top order part. Of course, by dividing by sigma, you can always reduce it to Laplace and U plus gradient of sigma dot gradient of U equal to zero, gradient of log of sigma, sorry, by dividing by sigma. Again, this is might not be a good idea either, but this is first order. So with this reduction, we can make it to zeroth order, but we have to take two derivatives of the conductivity in order to do that. And in fact, you can, if zero is not a Dirichlet eigenvalue for the Schrödinger equation, given any potential in L infinity, say, you can solve this equation. And define a Dirichlet to Neumann map, and this makes it useful for other problems as the normal derivative, just the normal derivative of the solution at the boundary. So you can consider a more general problem, take a potential in L infinity, solve the Schrödinger equation if you can, uniquely, if zero is not a Dirichlet eigenvalue, define the Dirichlet to Neumann map as exactly the normal derivative, and the question is, does lambda q determine q? This reduction is valid in any dimension. And in fact, the theorem is, the proof of the theorem I mentioned there is that this is indeed the case in dimension bigger or equal than 3. More general. It's valid for potentials, not just for the Schrödinger equation. Forget that this comes from the conductivity, and this has implications for scattering theory at fixed energy. I won't go into that. Now, this implies, and I'm not going to go through the arguments of that, the result. Equal to lambda 2. So you solve this problem, you solve the conductivity problem, not the other way around. And let me mention, since I see several young people in the audience, an open question in dimension 2. Is does lambda q determine q? The result of Adrian to this effect, which comes from the conductivity, this is true if the potential, in fact, comes from the conductivity. So you can solve the conductivity equation. Conductivity, the original problem, but not this potential problem, is not known. The result, I'm not that several you have tried, including myself, but we have failed to solve this problem. Okay, so let me tell you how to use complex geometrical optics solutions to solve that problem. And the lemma is that, and this comes back to really the point of view of Calderon, is that if the Dirichlet Neumann maps are the same, well, this is an identity. This is surface measure. Yes, comes by integrating by parts. Q U1 is Laplacian of U1. Q2 times U2 is Laplacian of U2. So you use Green's formula, and you derive this identity that if these are the same, this is zero. If UI solve the Schrödinger equation. And so the question really, so we have that this is equal to zero for all solutions, products of solutions of the Schrödinger equation. The question is reduced to whether the products of solutions are dense. So products of harmonic functions, whether products of harmonic functions are dense or not. That's so you have to manufacture many solutions of the equation, and that's what the complex geometrical optics okay, so the lemma, and this is complex geometrical optic solutions, and this is valid in any dimension bigger or equal than 2, also that. So given a complex frequency, if the complex frequency is sufficiently large, so I'm not going to write all the statement here. There is an M sufficiently large depending on the potential. I'm going to take my Q to be an L infinity and at N and say Q compact support for simplicity, all that's more general than this. So for large complex frequency satisfying rho dot rho is equal to zero, one can find exponential solutions of this form. Moreover, the solutions are unique. This is a solution of the Schrödinger equation in the whole space. This is very important for several things. The psi q is in a weighted space, and with a certain weight. I'm not going to specify. Well, let me just say what the weighted space is. Simple enough. You have some condition at infinity for this lower order term. Very similar to what comes in scattering theory. So there are solutions. I will explain a little bit more. Moreover, the solution is unique. So there is an existence and uniqueness. And the psi q in weighted norm goes to zero is less or equal than the constant times modulus rho. Goes to zero as rho goes to infinity. Okay, so let me explain a little bit more, because this is a very important lemma that has been used considerably in inverse problems. And this is what we will try to generalize to the anisotropic case. So what this is saying is the following, and that's why you need the Q to be lower order here, that there are solutions of the Schrodinger equation in the whole space. So I'm going to consider the problem in the whole space rather than just in the bounded domain, that behave like harmonic functions, because these are harmonic functions. Since Laplacian of e to the x dot rho is equal to zero, if this is true, if and only if rho dot rho is equal to zero. Okay. So let me go back here. There are solutions that behave like harmonic functions, and for large complex frequencies satisfying this condition, this decays in frequency. For large complex frequencies, this is small, and actually there is a bound, precise bound. The constant depends on the L infinity norm of the potential. Okay. So, how many solutions do we have? This is, gives you a large class of solutions. The condition that rho is in Cn, and rho, the rho is equal to zero, is equivalent to the following. You write rho, take the real and imaginary part. So rho dot rho is equal to zero if and only if eta dot k is equal to zero. So the real and imaginary part cancel out. I mean, are perpendicular. And the length of the real part is equal to the length of the imaginary part. So that's the difference in dimension three. That's the difference in dimension. In dimension two, you have very little freedom. You have a direction k, you can only take the perpendicular one with the same length. Given a k. So this is in dimension two. In dimension larger than two, you have a sphere, if this is k, of radius modulus k. This is the perpendicular to this. So there are, the larger the dimension, this is co-dimension two, the more solutions that you have. So that's the key point why this proof works in dimension three and not in dimension two. So let me finish the proof. So you use the fact that you have these solutions to get that the paradox of solutions is a dense set. So I take U1, I only need the solutions in the domain itself. So I write e to the U1 is equal to e to the rho x to rho 1 times plus a lower order term. As in the lemma, and I fix a k, a vector in an n, and for rho, I take rho to be eta plus I k plus l minus eta plus I k plus l. So this is fixed. So in order for rho 1, rho 2, in order for rho 1 and rho 2 to satisfy this, You have to have that the length of the real part is equal to the length of the imaginary part. And all the vectors are perpendicular to each other. So very important. This choice is made so that the exponentially growing or decaying part cancels out, and I only get oscillation. And these oscillations, the oscillations just coming from decay, and these other ones just cancel out. And here is where I use dimension 3 or larger, because I have the freedom to of that many directions. And now you plug it in into this identity. I plug it into this identity and I get integral q1 minus q2. When I multiply those exponentials, I get e to the 2i x dot k 1 plus i q1 equal to 0. Right? Just multiplying the solutions. But now I take the limit as L goes to infinity. This extra parameter, this free extra parameter that I have, which I don't have in dimension 2. There is no L in dimension 2. I don't have these extra variables. All of this goes to 0. And I get that the Fourier transform minus 2k of the difference times the characteristic function of omega is equal to 0. So this is true for all k now. So this implies all omega. So that's the whole proof. Well, you know, you need to fill in all the details. But okay, let me mention one. Here we only use the existence of the solutions. And we didn't use the precise estimate, only that this goes to 0 in L2 norm in the domain as rho is large. So there is a lot of flexibility there. The uniqueness of the solutions is using the reconstruction method that Adrian, and also I will use it in a moment later, so let me use the uniqueness of this solution to show something else. Uses uniqueness of a complex geometrical optics solution. I'm not going to explain that, but I want to explain the following consequence, that this is of why you construct the solutions in the whole space. It's not equivalent. I mean, this is a consequence of if the derivative normal maps are the same, then you get this identity. And we don't know in dimension 2 whether the products, if you would solve that question, I think you will be done. The products of solutions are dense, but may not be the only way to go around it, around that. No, it's not known. For potentials of the form of the conductivity, yes. But not for general potential. But this is in dimension 3 or larger, this is for general potential. Yeah. And the, as I said, the problem in dimension two, another problem is that you cannot take this this limit. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about this uniqueness of the solutions, because you know, I'm very bad in counterexamples, so I think it should be true. It's true, you know, for the potentials of that form. It's true for generic potentials. It's not for a, for an open and dense set of potentials that this is true. So there will, there may be exceptional points, but people believe, the people I know that are trying this problem are trying to prove it. I don't know, it will be very hard to find counterexamples, because you have to produce two potentials that give you the same measurement for any given data at the boundary. So it will have to be sort of very, very special kinds of potentials. Okay. So let me show you the following proposition that uses the uniqueness of the solutions, because it, as I said, this is important. Sorry? The result actually, you can prove that, but the result didn't go, the proof did not go that way. The proof, well, you know, Adrian can explain to you better than this, than me. You use these solutions in dimension two also, but in the case, so these are constructed for large frequencies, and that's the only thing that we use. In dimension two, first of all, because of the special form of the potential, it comes from the conductivity, you can construct it for all complex frequencies. And second, that's still not enough, because even if you have it for all frequencies, you have this identity here, right? You can't take limits. The next step, important step, is to take, these solutions are not analytic with respect to this parameter. So you take D bar, and you look at D bar of those solutions. So it involves an additional argument. But you can prove that the products of solutions are dense a posteriori for that particular case. Okay, so the proposition is that if the dirigible to Neumann mass for two potentials are the same, the solutions I just wrote down here, U1 and U2, are the same outside. So can these solutions are exactly the same outside the domain. And the reason is the following. Because you have let's define the following function. W solves the Schrödinger equation with potential 1 with data on the boundary, the solution U2 at the boundary. So here is your domain. So I'm solving with the potential Q1 here, but data U2 at the boundary. I'm not out of time, right? Then you take lambda Q1 of W. The dirigible to Neumann map is the normal derivative at the boundary by definition. But we know W at the boundary, sorry. But W at the boundary is U2 at the boundary. And U2 is a solution for the potential 2. Remember, Laplacian minus Q2, U2 equal to 0, in the whole space, in fact. So this is DU2, the normal derivative. And I'm going to extend the potential to be at 0 outside for simplicity. Okay, so what you have here is your solution W and U2 coincide at the boundary And the normal derivatives coincide at the boundary. So by unique continuation, you can extend the solution to the whole space. And since there is uniqueness of the solution, right, we have a solution, uniqueness of the loose solution, that's a part of the statement of the lemma, the U2 must be equal to the U1 in the complement. Okay, so that's very important in what I want to say next. It's used a lot. Okay. And it's not used in the uniqueness proof. It's used in the reconstruction proof and in other arguments that come up. Okay. Any questions? I'm going to leave now the three-dimensional case. Except to say that the problem is this proof breaks down immediately for the anisotropic problem. Can we construct complex geometrical optic solutions of some form? This is the problem in macroocular analysis. So in other words, we don't know exactly what we're looking for. So let me just write some phase function, then some amplitude. Something like this. I mean, I'm just making a guess of the type of solutions you're looking for. And in the case of the Schrodinger equation, this is x dot rho, but you don't expect it to be linear when you have it. Your equation is of the form plus lower order. This is in the top order term of the coefficients, and you cannot reduce it to lower order. Actually, in fact, there are geometrical obstructions to reduce Laplace-Beltrami operator to the standard Euclidean Laplacian. The problem is this phi has to satisfy an Econal equation, and this is elliptic, so this has to be complex. And we cannot do that in general. So this is a complex Econal equation. You can do it in some cases, for instance, in the real analytic case, when gamma is real analytic, or you can do it in the case where you expect the phi to be exponentially decaying. So this is like a complex phase Fourier integral operator. But we don't have any analog for phases that, you know, can be exponentially growing or exponentially decaying or oscillating. So that's the difficulty with this method. So we would like to find another method. And in the first lecture, I indicated the method that I would like to use to solve the geometric problem in dimension 3, this problem in dimension 3, but we don't know yet. So there is a point in trying to find a different proof, even in the isotropic case of that result. As far as I know, this, after many years, I don't want to count how many, and this is the only proof, the proof I know of this result, all of the proofs I know of this result used in one way or another complex geometrical optics solution. Okay, so let me go to the two-dimensional case. And I'm going to talk about the conductivity a little bit later, but let me start with the Laplace-Beltrami operator. So what I'm going to consider A two-dimensional surface now is a Riemannian metric, Mg. And I'm going to consider the Laplace-Bertrami, again, this is a Riemannian manifold. In fact, surface with boundary, connected, compact. I consider the Laplace-Bertrami operator. So once more in local coordinates, has been written out several times in this conference. Equal to zero, where Gij is the inverse of the metric G. And so I consider harmonic functions. I repeat once more, this is not equivalent to the conductivity problem. But it's a geometric problem of trying to recover the manifold and the metric from the Dirichlet-Neumann map. So the Dirichlet-Neumann map is exactly the same as defined before. It's the conormal derivative at the boundary. And as I pointed out yesterday, there is an additional obstruction in the two-dimensional case, namely the Laplace-Bertrami operator is conformal invariant. And so the theorem is this is the theorem of Lazarus and myself, is that the two Dirichlet-Neumann maps are the same, then we can recover the conformal class Mg. So you can recover the manifold, the topology. So in other words, for the metrics, it means that there is a change of variable, so that this is alpha times G2, where psi is a diffeomorphism. So the boundary is the identity. And again, there are no restrictions other than connectedness on the topology. Okay, the proof of this is a little bit intricate, and I'm not going to explain it here, but I'm going to give you the proof in the two-dimensional, in the case of Euclidean space. Because when you have manifolds, you have to patch together all these things that I'm going to do in. Right now it's a little bit complicated, and I want to talk also about the boundary distance function. So let me consider the case of a Euclidean space. And now, we can use isothermal coordinates. This is the main difference between dimension 2 and larger. In two dimensions, there is a uniformization theorem. Uniformization theorem in higher dimensions, as you all know, which is claimed, which is supposed to have been proven, is quite complicated. It will be very hard to, but in two dimensions, it's very very easy. And there is a result. In fact, I'm going to do it in the whole space. I'm going to extend the metric outside and to be Euclidean. It's the Euclidean metric, the Kronecker delta, outside some ball. Okay. I'm going to consider in the whole space. And alphas show that you can find isothermal coordinates in this case, so in other words, you can find a global diffeomorphism, so that the metric is a conformal multiple of the Euclidean metric r equal to 1 to 2, where these are positive functions. So you reduce it to the standard Euclidean Laplacian. And moreover, phi I. This phi I looks like the identity. So let me use complex notation. These sum conditions at infinity. So it looks like the identity at infinity. And these are, I can tell you the precise condition, but these are technical conditions. So Z is x1 plus I x2. Yes. We're in two dimensions. So this looks like the identity at infinity. And so therefore now it's very easy to which was very difficult in dimension 3 or larger to construct complex geometrical optic solutions, is very easy. Solutions of this are just are the Calderon exponential solutions, except that you have to change variables, because it's just a Laplacian. It's a multiple of the Laplacian. Harmonic functions are the standard harmonic function. And so it's very easy to construct the exponential solutions in that case. And these exponential solutions, because of this property, look like the complex exponentials for large x. And now, we have, because of if the Dirichlet to Neumann maps are the same. This is the assumption that we have. Then the solutions, you say we're ready, you know, this is the diffeomorphism. But the problem here, the diffeomorphism, of course, are not the identity at the boundary, they change the boundary. You have to find a diffeomorphism that leaves the boundary fixed. So, but we have the following, that U1 at the boundary, in fact, in the complement, the two solutions are the same. Remember, that was the uniqueness of the solution, exponential solution. So therefore, they are the same at the boundary. And so therefore, phi 1, you look at the form of the solution. Where did I write them? Where? Low right, here. You put an I, well, doesn't matter, of course. The I doesn't matter. Phi 1 must be equal to phi 2 outside. This is the key step. At the boundary in particular. And from there, the diffeomorphism is phi 2 inverse size. You can easily check, because this gives you a conformal multiple of the Euclidean metric for G1 and a conformal multiple of the metric for G2. You just check very easily that this phi 2 inverse composes phi 1, which is now this is identity at this is the diffeomorphism, and its identity at the boundary. And you check the psi star of G1, I think it's AG1 over AG, I did this as an exercise, or the other way around. I think I took the pullback. Well, it's either this one or the opposite. And there it is. So you can see the fact that you can construct these solutions and they are unique is crucial for this proof. And actually, this proof can be extended to the following. Any questions about this? We can consider a much more general situation. Right. It's from R2 to R2. So it has two components. Right. It's a diffeomorphism. It's the same as x dot rho for. My notation was a little bit. I wrote x in one point and z in another. But this in two dimensions, you can make the. You can make the identification. You can in a, so you can. This proof actually extends to the following situation. So suppose you consider. So again, we're in a Euclidean space, and we have a Riemannian metric. You can consider the divergence with respect to the metric G. This is the analog of the conductivity equation that one can define on manifolds. Okay, the conductivity equation as it is not invariant. So this, in the case of the Euclidean metric, this is exactly the isotropic conductivity equation. And if G is the inverse of the conductivity, and beta is square root of the determinant of gamma, or gamma anisotropic, This is the anisotropic problem. Okay, so this includes both the isotropic and the anisotropic problem. And I am writing it this way because this is an invariant way, and you would like to consider this problem on manifolds as well. This is the analog of the conductivity equation on manifolds. And you can show, this is the theorem, using the same ideas as I just indicated a moment ago. The theorem. This is joint work with Sikisan. If you have that, you have two parameters. Beta is a scalar function, positive. Are you tired? You know, I'm tired. I'm used to the American system of 50 minutes. And then I'm out. I can see in your faces that you may be going through the same process as me. So suppose now you have these two parameters. So the reason why I want to consider this is because, as repeat once more, this is really the invariant problem, the conductivity problem in two dimensions. It can be defined on manifolds. Then there exists a diffeomorphism, which is the identity at the boundary, so that beta 1 is the pullback of beta 2. So for functions, this just means beta 2 composed with psi. And G2 is a multiple of 1. So you can do both at the same time. Okay. So this implies when beta is equal to 1, the isotropic problem, but this is cheating because in order to prove this, we use the isotropic result of. And also implies the anisotropic problem, which was done in a different way, dimension 2, that's the proof in dimension 2 of the result, previous result, was to use isothermal coordinates to reduce it to an isotropic case and then use the isotropic case. You can do this directly here for this case by using complex geometrical optics solutions and using the isotropic result, because you can construct solutions of this form. This 2D. Thank you. I would like to have stated that in any dimension. This is 2D. I think I said at one point that we're going to consider the 2D case. Sorry. N equals 2. You can construct complex geometrical optics solutions by using isothermal coordinates. Right? And you use the same arguments as I indicated before. So this is, again, the key step. For any metric G and beta, you can construct solutions as this goes to 0, as rho goes to infinity, as before. But the main difficulty in these problems is to prove that the diffeomorphisms can be chosen to be the identity at the boundary. And for that, you use that these solutions are the same outside the domain as I did in the previous case. Okay. So this puts together several results in 2D and an open question. Here for the young people is, can we do this on manifolds? The problem there, for a general manifold, you have topology, you have holes and handles, you cannot use isothermal coordinates. So you cannot find these global solutions. You can do it locally. You can do it locally by going to Euclidean space and doing it there, but you have to patch these things together, and that's not so easy to do. So I believe that this is doable. It's a nice thesis problem, and you know, because this is similar to things that we had to do with Matti Lazas when we did the Laplace-Beltrami operator to patch together the what we know about locally. Okay. So as you can see, there are a lot of open questions for the electrical impedance tomography problem. So now I'm going to go to a completely different question. I only have 20 minutes, and I exhausted to what I call travel time tomography. And this is what Chris introduced yesterday in his beautiful lecture. So this seems like a completely different inverse problem from the start. So let me repeat for the situation here, and I'm going to do it on again, a compact Riemannian manifold with boundary, and although the motivation for this came from the Earth, trying to determine the substructure of the Earth. The only way you can do that, we know how to do that, well, there are two ways, in fact. One is by earthquake information, because they travel through the inner core. Right? You need waves that go through the inner core. So seismologists are very happy when there are earthquakes, not where they live or where their family lives. There was one in Japan recently, right? Seven in the Richter scale. Chile, you know, has produced the second largest earthquake ever in 1962, 9.5 in the Richter scale. Fortunately, it was in the south of Chile. It would have been in Santiago, it would have been a complete disaster, but it was in the south of Chile. Many people died, but. And the other way is underground nuclear explosions, right? Which both of them, none of them are very kind to humans, but that's the only way. And travel time is actually used. This is what they use to determine the structure of the Earth. And Chris pointed out, the Helgoliths and Wicker and Sopres in 1905, very early on, determined in the case that the metric is 1 times the Euclidean metric, and the sound speed depends only on the radius, they find a formula to recover this from the travel time. So the travel time is the distance function between the points in the boundary. Right? So dg of xy denotes the distance, the travel time from x to y with respect to the metric g. And let me point out once more, also, since he was not so sure that an anisotropic problem, which is of course of interest in geometry, is also interest to geophysicists because the inner core of the Earth has been shown to be anisotropic. Even the inner core of the Earth. Okay. So the so we also have, as Chris pointed out, that this is true. Besides, if you have an isometry, that at the boundary is the identity. So the question is, can we recover the Riemannian metric up to this natural obstruction? It's the same obstruction as in the electrical impedance tomography problem. DG, let me point out another connection, formal connection, is a function of 2n minus 2 variables. Right? X is in the boundary, Y is in the boundary. The Dirichlet-Neumann map has a kernel let me call it KG. Right. Every operator is uniquely determined by its kernel. This is a distribution of 2n minus 2 variables. Right. This is a distribution, has singularities on x equal to y, so that's this. Right. Another formal connection is that this is defined as the infimum of all the lengths of curves. I shouldn't call it gamma because that was conductivity. So how should I call it? No, that's bad. L, okay. Remember that this was equivalent to the Q gamma, the quadratic form. Well, because in the case of Euclidean space, let me point out, which was Gij dUdxj, the square root of the determinant of G in local coordinates. This is the quadratic form associated to the solution of the Dirichlet problem with data f on the boundary. You remember this information is equivalent to that. And that's the infimum of this functional applied to all solutions, all functions, I'm sorry, not solutions. These are solutions of the equation, so these are harmonic functions. So V, say, is C2 or some condition, and B at the boundary is F. So it comes from variational problems. This is the length, and these are solutions. So you have these things about solutions and curves or geodesics, notion. There is another connection here that I would like to point out. Which was a motivation for me, at least, is something I'm going to use anyway, so how to define is what Chris calls the length map and the I call it the scattering relation. So since I'm so used to doing this, and this is the way I learn it, so let me define what the scattering relation is. So this is the length. You call it map or relation? What have you? So from incoming angle and incoming direction to outgoing angle.
Oh,
and
length equivalent.
Length. Where does the name length comes in? Because they're coming in together. They're coming in. I see. Okay. So this is the following, and this is something that will come up in what I want to talk about later. Suppose you take a point in the boundary and a direction with norm 1 with respect to the metric. You started your geodesic with that direction, and you look at the point of exit, y, and the direction of exit. So let me put eta here. So suppose you know xc, the incoming point of the geodesic, so this is a geodesic, the incoming point and incoming direction, and from here you determine the outgoing point and the outgoing direction. And you also know the length. We know the length, the travel time. So we know the travel time plus this information about incoming angle. If you know the incoming angle, you know the outgoing angle. This is an additional information. So this is a scattering relation. Why do I call it a scattering relation? EG, XY. Yes, boundary. No, it says I know this map and I know the travel time. Let me put plus. Okay? So I know the travel time, I know the incoming point and incoming direction, and I go the outgoing, take the outgoing direction and the outgoing point. From this information, can we recover? Up to isometry. Okay, and there is no counterexample if MG is non-trapping, as far as I know. This is that's why I checked with you yesterday. I don't assume minimizing. So yeah, I should save travel time. You're right. Because there is not a unique geodesic joining the 2 points in the bound. Plus travel time. If MG is non-trapping, for me, this will mean that every geodesic has finite length. As Chris pointed out, from just the distance function, there are counterexamples, because the distance function only measures the first arrival time of waves, because it's the infimum. But however, if there are regions of low velocity in the Earth, there will be, like many of us are slower, it will take a longer time to get there, but that also gives you information. As in the example that Chris pointed out, is the standard metric on the sphere, and I always put the South Pole up. The distance function only takes into account the geodesic traveling across the boundary, because to go from there to there, that's the way you go. But doesn't take into account what's happening near Chile, right? That's not fair. And if you want to know what happens there, you better take geodesics going through there. So this is taking into account all the geodesics, information about all the geodesics. So there is hope that this conjecture might be true, but there are very, very few results about this. Okay, so why I mentioned the scattering relation in connection with this analogy which I'm making? Because if you project these vectors into the tangent space, this is a Lagrangian submanifold of the cotangent space. And that's the way that Guillemin actually considered the scattering relation. It's a wavefront set of the scattering operator, which is a Lagrangian submanifold. I mention this for people who know these words, they're just words. So alpha scattering relation. Determines a Lagrangian manifold. The wavefront set measures singularities, but also the direction of singularities. That's how the scattering relation comes up, because you look at the direction of a singularity and you see where it goes. That's a wavefront set. It's singularities in phase space. And the Dirichlet-Neumann map is also, you can see the graph of the cross this star, I'm sorry. Yes, of course, it's a function of two variables, thank you. Now, if you consider the graph of the Dirichlet-Neumann map, that's a Lagrangian manifold in infinite dimension. So this is in finite dimension. And the symplectic form here, it comes from Green's formula. I just was making this analogy to say it is not completely surprising the fact the theorem is in dimension 2. Let me make this very clear, that if you know dg, the distance function, so mg is simple. I want to say a little bit about the proof, but I will have to say a little bit at least. Mg is simple. And you know dg. So you know the finite dimension and analog of this. You can recover lambda g. And from here, it follows the result that every simple, as I pointed out yesterday, every simple Riemannian surface is boundary of EG. Okay. By combining the result with Lazar and the result of Mohometov and Krog, which is actually known in more generality. Both results, the result of Lazar and myself, is known for general manifolds, and the result of Mohometov was generalized by Chris to strongly geodesic minimizing surface, so it's known in more generality. Okay, as from here it follows that if we know dg, we can recover g up to a summary. Okay, so what does the proof use? The proof actually doesn't use the distance function so much. It really uses the scattering relation. So proof uses that, as Chris pointed out yesterday, is equivalent to the distance function if the manifold is simple. And of course, non-trapping we use this. And we use another fact, that's the only place really when we use simplicity of the metric, which is we need that the X-ray transform, the geodesic X-ray transform, is injective on functions and, well, forms up to equivalence. Up to, let me say a little bit about this. So let me tell you about this. So I already have talked about the scattering relation. This is incoming angle, incoming and direction, you know, the outgoing direction as well. Non-trapping means length of geodesics are finite. What is the geodesic X-ray transform? So the geodesic X-ray transform, so I'm going to take a point here, so let me consider half and an incoming direction C. So let me just say it in the case of a function first, is the integration from 0 to the length of the geodesic. So this will be the length of the geodesic starting at X with direction C. This is tau. Xc of the function evaluated against geodesic flow dt. So this denotes geodesic flow. So at point Xc, then you go along the geodesic and you take into account the direction also. So this is geodesic flow. And you can define this also for one forms or vector fields. And you can also define it for tensors and so on and so forth. I mean, these things come all over the place. This is the analog of the X-ray transform. I'm going to finish. Which is just integration along lines. Right? As Chris pointed out, you know, the in medium which are not homogeneous, light is going to travel along the geodesics and you get the integration along the geodesics, not along line. So the question is this transform invertible? Is it injective? And so on and so forth. You can ask the same questions. And much less is known than in the standard Euclidean case. And the result that we use strongly is that this is injective. And the dual transform, which I don't have time to define, is on function. And we also need information for I, the rate transform on vector field. It's not injective here, I don't have time to explain this. But we need to show that this is injective as much as it can be. And this is only known it's known for simple. This is the place where we use simple. That the transform is injective and this is onto. And this follows by looking at I star I. And an Ikonov theorem for vector fields. So Chris has a very nice proof of this for RSGM, regular strongly geodesic minimizing. So this can be extended a little bit. We don't know about that yet. And also you need to prove this, and that uses the fact that I star I, for the case simple, is a pseudo-differential operator. I'm just telling you words now. And that's not going to be true for SGM, but it will have certain singularities, but we think we can handle it. But uses this plus the scattering relation. This is the object one should really be looking at, and geophysicists do look at the scattering relation, not just the travel time information, but the directions. So that's, I'm running out of time. I was going to say more about the proof, but I needed 7 lectures.